You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday. It is time for our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. A lot going on in Washington, D.C., although I guess you guys are now officially on vacation.
Well, I wouldn't call it vacation. But we're not in Washington.
I know you wouldn't, because you're constantly out there talking to people, but some of your colleagues. Anyhow.
All right, here's what. Before I get into the vote on Syria, and I voted no on that, and I spoke on the floor, and I want to talk about that in a minute. I want to pick up on an interesting article that appeared in Media Matters. I don't know if you saw it, Tom. And it talks about the degree to which the television networks covered campaign finance and money in politics and Citizens United.
Right.
If you were to ask me, amidst all of the terribly serious problems that working families, the middle class, our country faces today, I would have to say at the very top of my list is the issue of campaign finance, is the issue of this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision, is the issue that billionaires are now able to buy elections and that the Koch brothers and other billionaires are spending hundreds of millions of dollars. Because no matter what issue you're interested in, jobs and the economy, minimum wage, pay equity, if you're interested in climate change, global warming, if you're interested in education or healthcare, all of those issues are impacted by campaign finance and Citizens United and the ability of billionaires to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to elect candidates who will represent the rich and the powerful in the fossil fuel industry. It's an enormously important issue. I was stunned that when we had the vote a week ago Thursday, there was almost no media coverage of the vote. Every Republican voted against the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. Totally partisan vote. Every Democrat and the independents voted, yes, we need to go forward with a constitutional amendment. Every Republican voted no. And there was a debate that went on for a number of days before that. Do you know how much news coverage the New York Times gave to that issue?
I don't.
Zero.
Oh. Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah.
And Washington Post did a little bit better, not much better. Turns out that Media Matters, which looks, they looked at the television networks. This is what they found. Since February 2013, when the Supreme Court accepted McCutcheon for review, NBC's Nightly News and Meet the Press covered campaign finance for a total of 17 minutes and 36 seconds over a year and a half.
Wow.
CBS's Evening News and Face the Nation combined for 17 minutes and 32 seconds. ABC World News Tonight was even worse. In other words, the most important issue facing our country, the degree to which the big money interests are now able to control the political process, the degree to which the Republican Party is now benefiting from that, gets virtually no coverage. And I think that is a sad state of affairs. And I want people, you know, to understand that no matter what the New York Times or CBS or NBC says, this is an enormously important issue. But they also point out, as by the way, PBS did a very good job and has devoted a lot of time to this enormously important issue.
Well, there's a real significant difference here. PBS does not, if $1 billion is spent on a campaign, probably 980 million of it is spent on television. And PBS doesn't get any of that money, and CBS, ABC, NBC get all of it.
To the nut of the issue here, and that is that if you are a television station and the Koch brothers and others are pouring huge amounts of money into you, you know what? May not be an issue that you want to talk about a whole lot.
Right.
But it gets back to something that you and I have chatted about a whole lot. Who determines what is most important, what the news is? And very often you will find media into gossip, into speculation, whatever they're into, rather than looking at the real issues that impact ordinary Americans. And that's something, you know, that we've got to continue the fight on. All right, let me switch gear here for a moment and tell you, yesterday there was I think, extremely important vote. And ostensibly what the vote was about was whether or not the United States, whether the president will have the authority to provide training and support for so-called Syrian moderates. I voted against that for a number of reasons. The main reason I voted against it is that I believe that at the end of the day, this effort against ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to call them, which is a terrible, brutal, dangerous organization, it is not going to be won by the United States. It will be won by the countries in that region, Muslim countries who may be Sunni and they may be Shiite, who are going to have to stand up and take these guys on. And what I fear is that, in fact, what this ISIS group wants, and they're pretty smart guys, what they want to portray to Muslims throughout the world is that this is a war between the United States and Muslims. This is a war between the West and the East. This is a war between Christianity, if you like, and Islam. And I think that we should not fall into that trap. Now, one of the points that I made in a speech on the floor yesterday, and most people don't know this, is that the country in the world which has the fourth largest defense budget, more than the United Kingdom, more than France, is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is spending almost $60 billion a year on the military, and that's a figure which some people think is pretty conservative. They have a significant fleet of modern aircraft. They have an army. And the question that should be asked is, why are they, who are certainly a lot more threatened by ISIS than is the United States or Europe, where are they in the struggle? Where is Kuwait in the struggle? Where is Turkey in the struggle? And where is Qatar in the struggle? Why is it that the United States is leading the effort? And I think we should be supportive, and I support the president's airstrikes. There's an important role for us to play. But the question is, how do you win a war when it is portrayed as the United States versus ISIS rather than the countries in the region, the Muslim countries, fighting their own fight with our support? That worries me. And second of all, I have a real time defending and understanding how taxpayers in the state of Vermont or Michigan or California should be putting money into this war when you have the royal family of Saudi Arabia who are worth hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. You know, I don't understand why people in this country can't afford to send their kids to college or paying more in taxes or going deeper into debt nationally rather than some of the wealthiest families in the world in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait. So those are the concerns that I have. And the other concern that I have is that once we get wrapped up into military involvement, it is harder and harder for the Congress and the media to begin focusing on the other major problems facing this country. Real unemployment, 12%. Youth unemployment, 20%. Minimum wage, starvation wage of 7.25 has to be raised. Pay equity for women who are earning 77 cents to the dollar for what a man earns. Climate change, the need to transform our energy system, campaign finance reform. There are enormous issues facing the American people, which I fear very much are going to be shoved underneath the rug by the Congress and by the media while we focus on Middle East all of the time. So a number of reasons why I voted against that. I voted against the war in Iraq in the first place. And I want to conclude my thoughts on this by saying I think the president has been unjustly criticized. Unlike Bush and Cheney, who got us into a war in Iraq, you know, I think the president is trying to think his way through this. But I disagree with his decision, and I look forward to seeing Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar and all these other countries come to the table and defend themselves and then get our support.
It's Brunch with Bernie, our hour-long national town hall meeting here with Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll be right back with your calls for Bernie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. You can easily track him down just with his name over both on Twitter and YouTube and Facebook. And welcome back. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, Senator, I saw you on one of the Sunday Republican talk shows. And, of course, all of the questions were trying to get you to criticize the Democrats.
Right.
I want to commend you for having the courage and honesty to not take the bait and for calling out the dysfunctional billionaire media on the show. I was shocked to learn it was your first appearance since you've been one of the only independents in Congress for years. You should be more in demand than anyone. Are you as outraged as I am that the billionaires control almost all of our public airwaves, and what can we do about it? Thanks.
Well, Paul, thanks very much for your question. I was on Meet the Press last week, and Paul is right. I've been in Congress for 24 years, longest serving independent in American history, and it was the first time that I was on. I appreciate them putting me on. But I think if you look at the folks who get on the Sunday talk shows and the folks who get a lot of the immediate media attention, you know, they are not going to be there representing and fighting for the rights of working families in the middle class. So nothing much shocks me, Paul. I've been around a little bit too long. But I want to reiterate one point, is when you turn on the TV in the morning, you pick up the local newspaper. The point to know is God didn't determine what's on the front page or what's on the news. These are human beings often working for corporate interests. And their determination of what is important is very different, in my experience, from what the average American thinks is important. Let me give you one example, Tom. Earlier this last week, Congressman John Conyers of Michigan and I introduced legislation to provide 1 million jobs for low-income young people. Youth unemployment in America, Tom, is 20%. What do you think about that? 20%.
Wow.
You don't hear much about that.
And it's even higher in minority communities.
And it is in African-American communities, it is 33%. Okay. Now, that sounds to me like a crisis. How much do you hear about that?
Not at all.
Okay. It's something that's wiped out. But you go to communities all over this country, and people are saying, I don't know how my kid's going to get a job. I don't know how my kid is going to be able to pay off college debt. There are 5.5 million young people in America who have either dropped out of high school or graduated high school. And you know what they're doing? They're doing nothing. They don't have a job. And I think that may give us some explanation as to why we have more people in jail than any other country on earth. Because many of these kids are hanging out on street corners doing nothing. They're looking forward to nothing. And the further that they are away from the economy, the longer they don't get a job, the harder it will be for them to get a job. You drop out of school, you don't get a job for a year or 2 years. You know what? There is a real chance you will never have a job. And if you never have a job, how do you survive? You do crime, you do drugs, or whatever you do, and you end up in jail. Rather than getting the job training you need, the education you need, and getting into society and being productive. But this is an issue that gets almost zero discussion. But it is an enormously important issue. So I have long understood that there is a correlation. Sometimes what I see in the media is just, you know, ridiculous stuff. It's gossip stuff, and yet really important stuff, like billionaires controlling the political process, youth unemployment, hardly any discussion at all. And we have got to change that. We have got to demand serious discussion on the serious issues facing America.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie hour. We'll be back with more of your calls for the Senator right after this. Welcome back. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator. On the line with us. You're there with us, Senator?
Right here.
Okay. Hope in Chicago. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Hope?
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's an honor and privilege to talk with both of you this afternoon. I am a precinct committee person in the Naperville Township in Illinois, District 28, which has been very historically conservative Republican, but I'm very glad to say it's changing through the years. And I have a comment and a question. Yesterday there was a caller who called in and who was very concerned because he felt that the government was going to be shut down repeatedly again in Obama's last 2 years. And, you know, that may or may not happen, but I am what people should be more concerned about presently is if they do not vote in this midterm election and we lose the Senate, I feel the Supreme Court stands a huge chance of going ultra-conservative. And then we will have a scenario that we should really be afraid of, which is domination in all the three branches of government. And I would like to know, I feel like we should be messaging that the GOP is also government, and they are the government opposed to people. We already know they're obstructionists, so we need a new a new advertisement.
Let's let Bernie get in here.
Let me say this to Hope, who is a committee, an activist.
Precinct committee person.
Committee person, ma'am.
Yes.
First of all, thank you. You are the unsung heroes, you and many others, of American democracy. And we need more people to do exactly as Hope is doing in 50 states in the country. It ain't sexy and ain't glamorous, but knocking on doors and making phone calls and talking to people is precisely what it is all about. As I think many Americans now know, the Republican vision of democracy is to do everything they can to suppress the vote, to make it harder and harder for older people, younger people, poor people to vote, to work as hard as they can coming up with gerrymandered districts, which are convoluted, which work to their political advantage. People don't know this. Democrats in the last national election, members of the House, Democratic candidates of the House, got a significantly more vote, larger vote, than did Republicans. But because of gerrymandering and so forth, Republicans control the House. And thirdly, their idea of democracy, after suppressing the vote and gerrymandering, is to allow billionaires to be able to buy elections. That's their vision of democracy. And our vision has got to be very, very different. And one of the things that all of us have got to do is exactly what Hope is doing, and that is do grass work effort. The pundits predict that all of 40% of the American people will be voting in this off-presidential election. 60% will not. And if that happens, it is, as Hope fears, very likely that the Republicans may gain control over the Senate, which will be a disaster for working families in this country. And the antidote is to raise that voter turnout. If you go from 40 to 50%, in my view, not only the Republicans not take over the Senate, they will lose the House. So our job is to bring out the vote, to make sure people understand what Republicans stand for, and that is huge tax breaks for the wealthy and large corporations. Under Bush, their effort was to privatize Social Security. In the Paul Ryan budget in the House, transforming Medicare into a voucher program, massive cuts in Medicaid, massive cuts in food stamps. We could not get one vote this week in the Senate for a bill for pay equity for women. That's who these guys are, and the American people have got to understand that.
Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. I got a simple way to end the problem over in Syria and Iraq. All we do is pass a law in Congress like you have for Cuba. Make it illegal for Americans to be there, and they will stop having their heads cut off.
Well, I don't know that that's the approach that I would advocate. People have a right to go where they want to go. ISIS is a brutal and dangerous organization. The real question, I think, is what is the smart way of defeating ISIS? I think they've got to be defeated. And what I have argued is that it cannot be the United States of America leading that effort. It has to be the countries in the region, Muslim countries, Sunni countries, Shiite countries, with American support, with the support of the UK, with the support of France, with the support of the international community. This cannot be an American war against ISIS. It has to be part of a broader coalition.
Yeah. Oh, we just have 10 seconds. Do you think that the Saudis are going to step up, Senator?
Well, I think that they have got to do that. And I think that they have got to know that the United States, our taxpayers, our soldiers can't do it for them.
Yeah. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting here, Brunch with Bernie, on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more of your calls for the Senator right after this. Be sure to check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. And he's got a very active Facebook page as well, over Facebook, and a great Twitter feed. But on Sanders.Senate.gov, you can also sign up for his newsletter, The Bernie Buzz, and it's a great news aggregated site.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So check it out, Sanders.Senate.gov. We'll be back with more Bernie and your calls right after this. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls at our national town hall meeting. And Robert, hang on just a second here. Click the wrong button. Robert in Cathedral City, California, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, how you doing, Senator Sanders? I have a question. If you run for president, would you consider Kashama Sawant as your vice president?
I have not met her personally. I think I'm going to meet her this week, and I'm going to be in New York City as part of this huge effort on climate change. But I hear she has done some very, very good work in Seattle, was one of the leaders there in helping to raise the minimum wage. But I am still a long way from deciding whether I want to run, let alone who will be my vice presidential candidate. But thanks very much for the call, Robert.
Kathy in Madison, Wisconsin, listening on the mic, 92.1 FM. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I'm so proud to talk to you. My question is, on the Internet, there's been a lot of talk about how involved John McCain and Lindsey Graham were with starting ISIL or ISIS. And now I'm looking at an article that's saying that they actually have been lobbied by the Saudis to sell the war, which is certainly what they have done. I feel manipulated that our country is being manipulated while we just stand by. So I'm just wondering what your comment would be. Are these things that are going around about John McCain and Lindsey Graham, which are, you know, certainly many people are saying is true, how do we deal with that? It doesn't seem right for a senator to be doing.
I have to tell you that I have not followed that discussion. I mean, I obviously know John McCain pretty well, and I know Lindsey Graham. I think the issue here is they have their views, and those are their views are, in general, a very aggressive foreign policy views. I think Lindsey Graham has been quoted as saying that he believes the United States should start sending troops into this foray into Syria. I strongly, strongly disagree with him. In terms of Saudi Arabia, the point that I made a few moments ago is that this country is an enormously wealthy country. This country has the fourth largest military budget in the world, a larger budget than France or the UK. And this is a country that has a very significant air force and army. And I think the American people have a right to say, why are we defending them if they're not prepared to defend themselves? Where are their resources? And this is not just a question of money or just even manpower. Symbolically, this military effort cannot look like it's the United States against the Muslim world. Muslims have got to be involved, and they have got to stand up. It's not just Saudi Arabia, it's Turkey, it's Kuwait, it's Qatar, and it is Iran. So I think we should be supportive, but I strongly disagree with Lindsey Graham, who talks about putting American troops on the ground. That is something I categorically disagree with.
Richard in Alamosa, Colorado, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you for your program, and thank you, Senator. It's an honor to speak with you. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I want to thank you for your brave vote yesterday and for all that you do for veterans and chairing the Veteran Affairs Committee. For the home of the brave and the land of the free, we don't need any more Gold Star mothers or increase their ranks. In rural Colorado and rural America, the veteran bill that was passed has left us really with no additional benefits, and the VA doesn't want to listen and communicate with organizations. We've actually formed a veteran coalition. There are several in Colorado. I'd like to invite you to the January 15th meeting. But is Congress going to take up this bill and start to deal with the problems that have not been addressed? For example, the 40-mile regulation actually eliminates almost all of 5,000 veterans in the valley where I live, because there is a clinic that what can't do anything more than give you a flu shot, test your blood pressure, or take blood. And we keep losing our doctors. We've been without a doctor for as long as a year and without nurses for as long as 6 months.
Okay, let me jump in, Richard, and thank you very much for your service and for your support. Let me tell you what we did do in the bill and what is happening with the VA. Number one, I agree with you. I'm not familiar with the situation in Colorado, but I am familiar with the situation in the United States. And that is that we have a significant shortage of doctors and nurses and other medical personnel. And that's why we put $5 billion into this legislation. And I can tell you that the VA is now actively starting the process of trying to bring more doctors and nurses and other medical personnel into the VA. So I hope and believe that that legislation will impact every facility in this country which is understaffed. And if that's the case in Colorado, it should impact you as well. In terms of the 40-mile-plus, I hear what you're saying, and I don't want to go into all of the details, but the VA has discretion to allow and spends, what was it? I think it was almost $5 billion last year contracting out. So if there are people who need certain types of medical help that their local community-based outreach clinic, CBOC, cannot give them, they can get that help. They can go to a private physician or another type of physician. So that is up to the discretion of the VA. And lastly, I know that Secretary McDonald has asked every VA in the country to have town meetings, to reach out to veterans, bring them in, and to say, you tell us what the gaps are here, what you need to happen. And I hope and expect that's happening in Colorado as well.
Ken in Ticonderoga, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Bernie.
Good afternoon.
I voted for you in 82 in Burlington to run the town. I'd like to see you run the country, but leave that aside for the moment. How about we get some equal play for energy retrofits here in the country so we can help make the Middle East irrelevant? When we talk about putting, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into blowing people up, we ought to be spending an equal amount here, retrofitting homes, $2,500 a piece average. For $500 million, you do 200,000 homes, you make Middle East oil go away as a reason for relevance and strategic importance.
Ben, that is a great question. You make a great point. A few years ago, I authored a bill with Bob Menendez of New Jersey called the efficiency block grant, energy efficiency block grant program, which brought billions of dollars, I think it was $3.5 billion or so all over the country into energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And Ken's point is absolutely right. What we've been doing here in Vermont, and I know many other states have been doing it, is putting money into weatherization and energy efficiency. And what we have in Rutland County here in Vermont, there are about 1,000 homes that have been weatherized. The result of that, Tom, is that people see a 32% reduction in the amount of fuel they have to use, 32%. And obviously that means there's 32% less carbon going into the atmosphere, and we are creating jobs as well. So I believe absolutely that Ken is right. And it's not a question of spending hundreds of millions. We should be spending many, many billions of dollars. And this will pay this will pay for itself, because when people's fuel bills go down, they'll be able to pay off the loan that they needed to retrofit their home. So Ken's point is a very, very important point, and I agree with it.
Zachary in Chicago, Illinois, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call. Senator, I just wanted to let you know I'm so proud of your work that you're doing and your moral character. I actually named my son after you. And what can I do to encourage you to run for president? Because we need you as bad as we need oxygen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Let me just say a word on this presidency issue. I was in Iowa last week, and I know you and I did the show, I think, on Thursday, Tom, and I think I was out there over the weekend, and we had a great time. and the turnout was really, really very good. We had 450 people on Sunday night in Des Moines, which I gather is a very large crowd for Iowa, and it was an enthusiastic crowd. I think the issue is that the American people know that something is fundamentally wrong with our country when so few people have so much and so many have so little, and when we're seeing a collapsing middle class while billionaires are doing phenomenally well. And the American people want these issues discussed. So I, you know, as I've said many times, I am giving thought to it. But if you do something, you want to do it well, and this is a massive undertaking. We've got 50 states in this country. We'd be taking on the Koch brothers and the other billionaires. And it would be, you know, how do you put together a strong grassroots movement in 50 states? Is there support for the kind of ideas that we're talking about? How large is that support? So those are some of the things that I'm thinking about. But I can say that the trip to Iowa, I thought, was pretty good. And there is a lot of support for the ideas that we talk about.
And with the Democratic primaries coming up, are you leaning toward running as a Democrat if you do?
Well, there's arguments both ways on that one. I am the longer-serving independent. But there are pluses and minuses of running as an independent, pluses and minuses running as a Democrat. That's something I'm trying to sort out as well.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls in our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be right back with more of your calls for the Senate. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, Sanders.Senate.gov. And you can also track him down quite easily. A very, very large website over on Facebook and a good Twitter feed. And welcome back, Josh. And hang on just a second here. Got to hit the right buttons. Josh in Algona, Iowa. You are on the, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Tom, a huge fan, and Senator Sanders, please, when you come back to Iowa, you got to make a stop in Algona. It's the county seat of Kossuth County. We'd love to have you. Please come to northern Iowa.
My geography of Iowa is not good. We're going to be in Johnson County. Is that anywhere near where you live?
That's about 2 hours south. I'd love to come and see, that's for sure.
Okay.
When you make your run, Senator, and you got to visit all 99 counties, we'd love to host you.
Okay. Is that what you got? Is 99 counties?
99 counties, yeah.
A lot of counties.
Kossuth County was supposed to be two counties, but it was about 2 miles short, so we were at 99 counties.
Wow. But anyway,
Senator, my question for you, you actually answered my original question. So my other question was, why are we having such a hard time getting Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Turkey, and everybody in the Middle East to step up to the plate and take care of a problem that affects them way more than it affects us?
Now, you're exactly right, Josh, that's exactly right. Look, this ISIS is a horrible organization. It is a murderous organization, a terrorist organization. Dangerous organization. It is awful. But if you think it is a danger to the United States, it is a heck of a lot greater danger to the nations in the area. As Josh said, we're talking about Saudi Arabia, you're talking about Kuwait, you're talking about Qatar, you're talking about Turkey. And what Josh is asking is, where are these guys? Why aren't they defending themselves? Why aren't they taking on ISIS? I think there are two reasons. Number one, they have grown into the habit of thinking, why do we have to do anything? The United States of America is there. Their taxpayers are there. Their armed forces are there. Their young people are there. Why should we have to do anything? That's number one. And number two, to be frank with you, all of these countries are autocratic countries run by zillionaire families. And I think they have a fear that if they get involved in this war, there may be uprisings or revolts within their own countries. But that speaks to the need for these countries to democratize, to give power to their own people rather than just the royal family. But the bottom line is, the longer we do it for them, the longer we defend these. In Saudi Arabia, my guess is that family is worth hundreds of billions of dollars. They have huge amounts of oil money. I think Americans are saying, I don't understand why our taxpayers, our young men and women, are defending them when they don't want to jump into the foray, especially when they are spending the fourth largest amount of money on defense of any country on earth. They're spending more than the UK and France. They have a lot of military resources. And before our kids get involved in that war, I think maybe they want to defend themselves.
You know, another irony is that the Saudi government and the Saudi royal family are both large buyers of U.S. bonds. They are essentially loaning us money and then asking us to spend that money that we borrowed from them on defending them.
Right. I mean, it's a little bit crazy. But, again, it's not even the money is important, you know, whether, you know, the loss of life is obviously enormously important. We don't want to lose more men and women in war. But what is perhaps even more important, at the end of the day, in my view, and people who know more about this agree, you don't win the war if it's the United States against them. They are going to have to win the war themselves.
Yeah, this is a regional conflict. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls. Back with with Senator Sanders in just a moment. Stick around. Back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Is Hobby Lobby a person? No, I don't think so. It's the Tom Hartman program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Jody in Lexington, Kentucky, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for your vote yesterday, Senator Sanders. I totally agree with you. They need to step up to the plate themselves. My question for you is about the Democratic Party, however. In the 2008 election, they had a forum that all people could participate in and give their ideas on strategies and issues. Why have they pretty much closed that door? Why don't they want to hear from us anymore?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, Jody. I believe, you know, and it's not what I believe, it's what the facts are and what every poll shows, is there is growing discontent with both major political parties. I think people perceive the Republican Party has become a far-right party, and people perceive that the Democratic Party is not standing up, taking on the big money interests and representing working people. So I think if the Democrats are going to be successful, A, they need a 50-state strategy. They can't ignore large parts of the country. And B, they have got to open up their doors to ordinary people. And I think what has happened, it's been exacerbated by Citizens United and big money in politics, is with 24 hours a day, you got a lot of these guys who are forced to go into fundraising events, and they are ignoring the grassroots of the Democratic Party. And I think at the end of the day, as important as money is, and it is important, there has to be more reaching out and involving ordinary citizens in the political process. What are their views? What are the issues that they think are most important? What role can ordinary people play in the political process? I happen to believe that grassroots politics is where it is at. There's nothing better, nothing more effective than knocking on doors and talking to people.
Charles in Chico, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Mr. Sanders.
How are you?
Charles, you're on the air.
Thank you, Senator Sanders, for taking my call. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I've been very concerned. Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, you got to listen to your phone, Charles. The TV has a delay. Just ignore the TV or turn it down and ask Senator Sanders your question.
I've become very concerned about the high suicide rate amongst veterans. And I've looked into some of the outreach programs that the VA is doing. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and basically I find there's not a real outreach program for this going on in the VA. Could you shed some light onto that, please?
Sure. Well, first of all, Charles, thank you very much for your service, and I think if I can say this, everybody, or virtually everybody, recognizes that the way Vietnam vets were treated when they came home was horrendous. They were said thank you, and they were just sent off back home without jobs, without training, without the kind of health care that they needed. And hopefully we have all learned a significant lesson from that. Charles, I think the issue of suicide and mental health among returning vets or vets in general is of real concern. The suicide rate, especially among younger veterans right now, is of real, real concern. We are likely to do a hearing just on that issue when we return from the break after the election. We, in various states around the country, there are outreach programs. I helped bring in some money here in the state of Vermont for the Vermont National Guard, which does a very effective, I think, outreach program, just knocking on doors, talking to veterans, checking in, see how they're doing, seeing what kind of help they and their families may need. That effort may not be as strong as some other states, but there is federal money going out there into the VA to do just that. So, Charles, you're right. It is a very serious problem. I think we're making some progress, but I do think we have to do a lot better.
Zach in Phoenix, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, how are you?
Good.
Good. I just have a question. Everybody is asking you if you're going to run for president, but as your supporters, I think some of us would like to know who you would vote for.
If you were not running.
If I were not running. Okay. Well, I don't know who will be running. I certainly am not going to vote for the Republican candidate, that's for sure. If there's a primary and I'm not in it, we'll see who is in it. But it's a little bit premature because I think there are no announced candidates right now. But obviously, Zach, as I think you know, I am perhaps the most progressive member of the United States Senate, and I want to see a progressive candidate run, and I want to see a progressive candidate become the next president of this country. The working class and the middle class of this nation need not only a voice, but they need action. They need somebody who is going to take the case to Congress that instead of worrying about the millionaires and billionaires, maybe it's time to worry about the vast majority of the people in this country who are losing ground economically.
Senator, we have about 45 seconds to wrap up the show. Your thoughts?
All right, let me just say this, and it's kind of my usual mantra here, is Republicans do well when voter turnout is low. And they would like to see lower-income people and younger people not voting, and they make it hard for those folks to vote. But on the other hand, if people are serious about beginning to address some of the monumental problems facing our country, I could tell you that a Republican Senate and the continuation of a Republican House will move us in the wrong direction. It will mean more attacks on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, nutrition, environment. You know, I'm just trying to think that if the Republicans gain control of the Senate, it is likely that the next chairman of the Environmental Committee will be somebody who doesn't even acknowledge the reality of climate change. And that is obviously not something that we want to see happen. So I hope everybody puts their shoulders to the wheel and that we get out a large voter turnout and we do everything that we can to spread progressive ideas.
Senator Sanders, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, Robert Rector, a senior research fellow with the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org, and co-author of this new piece, The War on Poverty After 50 Years, Robert Rector and Rachel Sheffield. Robert, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on.
I've read your report, and you know, a couple things come to mind. One, you point out that, you know, we're spending more and more and more to stop poverty, and we don't seem to be stopping poverty. And looking at the chart on page 3 of your background, or total means tested welfare spending and official poverty rate 1947 to 2012, it really looks like the spending on welfare exploded after the Reagan years.
Uh-huh.
And what about, you know, the FDR once said the best welfare program is a job.
Yes.
Why don't, if we want to eliminate poverty, why don't we do a couple of really simple things that harken back to that era, which is, number one, why don't we raise the minimum wage to a point where a person who is working at the minimum wage is no longer poor and therefore no longer eligible for these poverty programs, number one. And number two, why don't we raise taxes back, you know, roll back the Reagan tax cuts. They haven't worked. They've been a disaster for this country. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Get the hot money out of the system. Stop all the speculation and the gambling that's going on. And number three, why don't we bring our jobs back home? Why don't we follow an intelligent trade policy?
Well, I do think that a work-oriented welfare system would be exactly the way to go.
I'm talking about government as employer of last resort.
That's not a bad idea at all. In fact, that's sort of what we were trying to do with welfare reform in the 1990s, where you take the existing welfare system, but you say, look, in order to get these benefits, you have to either get a job. If you can't get a job, you have to come down here and prepare, take training, at least search for a job under supervision. And that worked very well in increasing employment. And I think you could go farther than that, in the sense that you could take some of this spending and put it directly into job creation. I think that would be a vastly better thing to do than just giving people money because they're in need. That was sort of the original vision that Johnson had in launching the war on poverty. As I note in the paper, Johnson actually said with extreme harshness that he wanted to turn the poor from tax eaters into taxpayers. Those are his terms.
Sure.
Johnson, you know, has a bit of hot air in him, but I think he actually was sincere about that.
Well, see, essentially the same thing FDR said. The best welfare program is a job. Now,
Johnson,
what this doesn't account for is the large number of disabled people and children and children with single parent who are poor, who really, you know, asking them to participate full-time in the job market is a fantasy.
Well, maybe full-time it's a fantasy, but I think really since the 1980s, there's been a consensus that we want the single mothers, who are the bulk of, if you take that, all of that welfare spending that's in my paper, it's $940 billion. That doesn't include Social Security and Medicare, and about a third of the population gets some type of benefit from these programs. But half of that does go to the disabled and to elderly in nursing homes. So the remaining part of it is largely going to families with children, and in particular single-parent families. And so if you want to deal with dependents there, you do have to have work requirements on the single moms, maybe not 40 hours a week. I think that's a valid point on your part.
Why not recognize motherhood, or fatherhood for that matter, as having as much integrity as flipping burgers at McDonald's? It seems to me like it's actually a more important job. It's investing in the future of our country. Most countries around the world, you know, if you're a, quote, housewife in Sweden, you get Social Security for that.
Yeah, I agree with your point on the value of it. But I think what we've learned is that having single mom staying at home with kids in isolation for a long period of time really didn't work very well. And that was the gist when Clinton came in and said he was going to end welfare as we know it in the 1990s.
Right, but it devastated the program. You know, the Clinton's reform, which was essentially you got 5 years to get a job and then you're out of here. See you later, Charlie. That was fine when we were in a bubble economy that was the result of all this hot money flowing around from the Reagan tax cuts. But, you know, that bubble burst.
Yeah.
And those jobs are not there. Absolutely. And the social safety net was ripped apart during the Clinton years by Newt Gingrich and his buddies.
If you look at my charts there, you see the social safety net is actually getting much bigger after that.
Well, because the need for it is so much larger because of Reaganomics.
I would also even back up on that, because I don't want to put any mother in particular who's coming to the society and saying, I can't support my child. I'm not going to say to her, I'm sorry, you've had 5 years. Go away. What I do want to say is anybody who comes and says, I really can't feed myself, I need assistance, I think that we need to be there to help them. But I do think in all circumstances that should never be a one-way handout if the person is able-bodied. And so the best system, which was the core of what went in the 96 reforms, although it does have time limits, those have never really been enforced, is this reciprocal obligation, so that when someone does come in and is getting aid, you say, yes, we will give you aid, but we expect you, and you can't find a job, that's fine, we expect you to come down here to the office and, you know, take job readiness or take some training, or at least search for a job in a way that we can see what you're doing. And what you find, and that works well in bad economic times, you can ease it off. In good economic times, you push it down a little bit, but you've got the safety net there. And that's my principle. I wrote and designed a large part of the 1996 reform, and that's always been my core. And I've also always said, you just can't cut people off. You can't just say, oh, your time is up, goodbye, we don't care about you anymore. That's not really going to work. But on the other hand, you can't just say, hey, you're in need, we'll give you stuff. Because when you do that, you essentially sort of breed an additional need for aid. Also, if you spend time in welfare offices, you know, clearly some of the people that are coming in there probably don't really need the aid. And they've got other options. And if you do put a work requirement or some type of activity requirement on it, that is a very good way of separating out the people who really need the aid from those who don't. And then you can actually...
Isn't it a good way to punish people who need aid?
Hmm? What?
There's no jobs. Isn't this just punishment?
I think at this time that there are no jobs. I agree with you absolutely. I do think, though, that it takes a long time, for example, to put work requirements into these welfare programs. I've been trying for 20 years, since the welfare reform in the 1990s, to put a work requirement onto able-bodied single
people. But see, one of the predicates of that era...
But as I said to you, in a bad economic times, you can ease those back. But yeah, we don't have these work requirements even when you're in the middle of a boom. And that's really the issue.
One of the predicates of that era, though, was that people need to learn how to speak and dress and be ready for the workforce, all this kind of thing. That was not so much the case when we had manufacturing in the United States.
Yes.
Anybody could show up for a factory job and raise a family based on it. That's our trade policy. Shouldn't our trade policy be at the center of this? Other countries have rational trade policies. China, Germany, Japan. Why not us?
I think that probably doesn't help the economy overall, but I would agree with you exactly that you do have a shortage of jobs, particularly in inner city areas. And so a policy that focused on creating jobs there would be a much better one than just a policy that focuses on giving people things and not requiring anything back in return. A job ennobles, that's what Johnson understood, that's what FDR understood, right. And we ought to go back to that. We also need to deal with the real underlying cause of child poverty, which is the collapse of marriage in low-income communities, which is...
Well, that's a whole other Pandora's box. But Robert Rector, Heritage.org. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So if you were king for the day, how would you deal with poverty in the United States? I'll share my ideas after this. And also, it's Anything Goes Friday. And welcome back. I just wanted to remind you, we had the wrong video plugged in for the top of the hour. We can't run the pledge drive during Bernie's segment because he runs it on his Senate website, and we don't want to be... There's legal problems with that. But at the top of the hour, we should have pointed out to you, we're having Free Speech TV. This is day five of the pledge drive, and Free Speech TV needs your help. So please call them now at 877 what is it, 877-378-8669. In fact, I've got that magic number written down right here. I just need to put it in front of me where I can see it. 877-378-8669. And give them a shout. I mean, there's all kinds of goodies that you can get. They can explain it to you, you know, if you watch this program. But they're... Free Speech TV, a number of people called when Senator Sanders was on and said, you know, our media sucks, basically. I mean, you know, the Senator Sanders was pointing out this Media Matters piece. And this is pretty shocking, actually. I think I've got it here, this article by Media Matters that pointed out that, no, I don't, that pointed out that in the run-up to, oh, here. In the year and a half since the McCutcheon decision, or McCutcheon was taken before the Supreme Court, February of 2013, until today, the total amount of time that was spent on ABC News talking about McCutcheon, Citizens United, campaign finance reform, billionaire, you know, all this stuff was 12 minutes and 33 seconds in a year and a half. It's like, what, 6 seconds a day or something? I mean, it's nothing. That was ABC. CBS was 17 minutes. NBC was 17 minutes. The PBS NewsHour was an hour and 13 minutes. Pretty conspicuous difference, right? Well, the PBS NewsHour is not funded by political ads. And the big three networks are all funded in large part by political ads. And if we say, hey, you know, the last election cost $1 billion. This election's going to cost $2 billion. The next presidential election is estimated to... Now they're talking about $4 to $6 billion. Where's that money go? Excuse me. Where does that money go? It goes to the TV stations. So it shouldn't be a surprise that they're not talking about what, frankly, is the most important issue in American politics right now, which is the absolute corruption of our legislatures, and not just at the federal level, at the state and local level as well, by big money. Principally from billionaires and multimillionaires and corporations, including foreign corporations. And it's not being discussed in the media because the media gets that money. But it is being discussed here. And that's why Free Speech TV needs your help. You are our Koch brothers. So give Free Speech TV a call, 877-378-8669. Pitch in, make a contribution. You can make it a monthly contribution for a year or whatever amount is comfortable for you. You know, would you give up a pizza a month? Would you give up a cup of coffee at Starbucks a month? Would you give up, you know, what might it be that what you can afford that reflects your consumption of Free Speech TV and helps the network? So please give them a call right now, 877-378-8660. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past three. Media for the sane among us, and it's Anything Goes Friday. This poverty conversation, I think, is an interesting one, but it tends to be a little wonky. I think, you know, it's really simple: guaranteed minimum income for everybody in the United States, right? Let's do like Alaska does. Let's say that all of our mineral wealth in this country is the property of everybody in the United States. And no more Jed Clampets. There are no Jed Clampets up in Alaska. If you have land and they discover oil on it, hey, that's the property of Alaska, that oil. So, you know, let's do that nationwide and produce a guaranteed minimum income. Let's start a wealth tax like Colombia is doing. They're saying, oh, if you've got over $1 billion, you're going to have to pay 2% every year on that money. They've been doing this since 2002, and what has happened? Their economy is now the fastest-growing economy in South America, or one of the top three, anyway. It's, you know, it's pretty straightforward stuff. We just need to roll back Reaganomics and go back to the kind of economics that worked, that built this country in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s. You know, simple Keynesian economics. So, anyhow, that's my rant, and I'm sticking with it. Now, to Anything Goes Friday and your calls. Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is more for Senator Sanders, but I guess you probably would know as well. How do we compete with, in my opinion, all the lies and the hatred that Fox News and these horrible media outlets, how do we stop this? This is insane, because I truly believe all the hatred is coming from these kind of stations.
Yeah.
And isn't it somewhat treasonous, some of the things they say?
Well, I think it's a violation of the founding principles of this country. I mean, our country was founded on the principles of the Enlightenment, the idea that we can govern ourselves, that people are inherently good, that we work together in community for the common good. And you know, what so-called conservatives have found, given that their agenda is 90% economic, it's all about, you know, screw the working person, screw the poor people, and make as much money as possible for the people at the very top of the pyramid. And in that context, I think it's really important for us to note that if that's what you're selling, you know, tax cuts for the poor, for the rich, increased taxes, like Reagan doubled the Social Security tax, the working person's tax, doubled it, you know, and while he cut taxes on rich people from 74% down to 28%. If that's your agenda, you can't sell that to the American people. So instead, you've got to talk about, oh, my God, there's brown people coming across the southern border. Maybe they're even carrying rabies. Who knows? You know, there's brown people in the Middle East who are beheading us. We've got to go drop bombs on them. There's people who, you know, want to take your guns away. I mean, there's actually a whole thread and meme that over in the right wing blog sites that the Obama administration is racially profiling for gun control. They're going after white people. Right? I mean, this is nuts, right? All of this stuff, Rush Limbaugh saying, you know, well, with some women, if you know what you're doing, yes, no means yes. I mean, all this kind of stupidity and hatred and misogyny and racism and all that stuff. The reason it's there is because there's an audience for it. There are people for each one of those things who are afraid, who are angry, who are convinced that everybody's out to get, who don't understand that they have been screwed by the billionaires and the transnational corporations and the Republican Party, and they're looking around going, my life is a wreck. I got no money. I'm in debt. My kids are in debt. Who do I blame? Oh, they're saying, you know, a black person is going to get my kids' slot in college because of affirmative action, or a brown person from Mexico is going to get, you know, my job because, you know, but it is not the black person or the brown person or the woman in the workplace or whatever who is, quote, the enemy of the let's face it, this is the white working middle class that most of this hate talk is directed at, and who is the major consumer of it. What it really is it's the Republicans and the conservatives and the billionaires. And we just need to keep telling our truth, Linda. We need to, and, you know, tell people about the show, you know, and do your own show. Every time you see somebody, just take these talking points and go with them. That would be my suggestion.
I do. I mean, I have a family. And I'll leave you with this. And my husband, when I married him, I've been married 33 years to him. I love him. And I said to him, honey, don't vote for Reagan. Please don't vote for Reagan. He's really bad for the country. And he was a conservative. He says, oh, no, honey, he's great. I says, no, honey, he's a good speaker because he's an actor, but he has no sense of government. And his family is so hooked that I give them talking points. I give them your site. I give them homework. And they look at me like, this isn't true. How do you convince these people?
Well, some you can't. I mean, there are people who watch Fox News and they live in that bubble. They listen to right-wing talk radio. It's a whole self-reinforcing thing. That's the bad news. The good news is that it's a relatively small number of people. The number of people who watch Fox News on a good week is around 3 million. The number of people who listen to Rush Limbaugh is maybe that, maybe twice that, maybe three or four times that. But it's still, in a country of 320 million people, that's a very small number of people. So I think that, you know, as Jefferson said in his letter, you know, about the Adams administration, you know, the time of witches shall pass, right? The era of bad mojo, not to diss witches, right? Which witches have our respect now, but the era. I think these guys are hanging on by their fingernails to the very last of the hatred and bigotry that they can promote. Linda, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The other thing we could do, of course, is we could ask that the president start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. This is something the Justice Department can do and break up the big networks. I mean, that's simple. Hey, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, just a couple of quick announcements. One night only, day after tomorrow, Sunday night. Here in Washington, D.C., if you're in the neighborhood and you would like to get together with me and Dan Sisson at Busboys and Poets, the K Street and 5th location in Washington, D.C., we will be there at 5 p.m. There's a link over at our website at tomhartman.com for that. You don't need to sign up in advance or anything, but, you know, it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be talking about the revolution of 1800 and the possible revolution of 2014 or 2016. We'll see. So it's going to be a great time, number one. Number two, Sammy Youssef. He's going to be at the Strathmore on September 28th. Strathmore.org is where you can get the tickets in North Bethesda, Maryland. It's a concert that benefits the Foundation for Traditional Studies and features music from his new album, The Center. And finally, welcome to our two newest radio station affiliates, WVHC in Herkimer, New York on 91.5 FM and WUBA in High Springs, Florida on 88.1 FM. Now, both airing the Tom Hartman Program. We're so glad to have you with us. So, that said, as I said, it's Anything Goes Friday, so let's get back to your calls. Dave in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, about 6 months or so ago, you said you knew a lot about either microeconomics or macroeconomics.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell me which one you knew about.
Well, I learn a little bit more about both every day. What did you have a specific question?
Yeah, which one you knew about and which one you didn't know about, what it encompasses.
Yeah. Well, you know, macroeconomics is broadly the big picture of how things work, you know, how economies work, the idea of demand-driven versus supply-driven, for example, you know, would be considered macroeconomics. The role of a central bank in an economic system, the role of trade in economics. Those are things that I'm fairly well versed in. I've written books on microeconomics, arguably, and again, these terms are very, very fungible is the wrong word, but you know, there's a lot of different ways that people apply these terms. But microeconomics would be more of, you know, okay, here in this community in Seattle, we're going to take the minimum wage up to $15 an hour. What is the effect going to be? Or we're going to start paying restaurant servers instead of $2 an hour the minimum wage. What is the consequence of that going to be? Or here's our welfare policy. You know, as you can see, there's a lot of crossover between the two. But did you want to go to a particular place with that, or were you just curious about the terms?
I was just curious about the terms.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's you know, I think that rather than worrying about whether something is macro or micro, macro meaning big and micro meaning small, we just all need to be more educated about economics in general. And the best books that I've written on that topic, if you have an interest in it, are Screwed, which is basically about how Reaganomics has eviscerated us, and The Crash of 2012, The Crash of 2016. Which is my newest book, and it talks about the intersection of economics and politics. So, you know, some places you can start. Dave, thanks for the call. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, you want to talk about the Middle East?
Yeah, hello, Tom.
Hey, Corky.
It looks like they're finally going to get their war.
Yeah, at least until Christmas.
Yeah, well, you know, the middle class would be still in the blood, and we don't ask anything from the wealthy.
Right. Especially the Saudi wealthy, as Bernie pointed out.
Yeah, and the Saudis are involved on both sides. They're playing both sides against the middle.
I was astounded. I did not. And here I am, a talk show host, a fairly well-informed person. I read the, you know, four newspapers every day. I pay attention to what's going on. I had no idea that the fourth largest military in the world is Saudi Arabia, larger than France, larger than the United Kingdom. They have a bigger army, a bigger navy, bigger air force, larger defense spending. I had no clue, and that the fourth largest military force in the world is Saudi Arabia, and they have and they want us to fight the ISIS. Well, that, I mean, you know, what? Really?
Muslims are not allowed to kill Muslims, according to the Koran.
Well, you know, tell that to ISIS.
Well, they're not Muslims. They're just, they're thieves.
Yeah, yeah.
They're a band of thieves. And
they, well, they have,
they
actually, you know, apropos of that, you know, they went after the Yazidi. These are not Muslims. They went after Christians. They're beheading American journalists who are, one of them was Jewish, one was Protestant. So, yeah.
If they get one of our soldiers over there and behead them, we're going to be in a war for the next 20 years.
Oh, of course. We're looking at Vietnam all over again, and it's crazy that we're doing this. At least this time, instead of just, you know, George Aiken, you know, we've got, I think, what was it, 20-some-odd people in the Senate yesterday voted against this. Over 150 people in the House voted against it. It wasn't a majority. It wasn't enough to stop it. It wasn't even enough to filibuster it. But it was enough to say, hey, wait a minute. And, you know, we've got the elections coming, and they only funded it until after the elections. They only funded it through November or maybe the early December. And so, but my question is, the funding, here's a $500 million to find a, quote, moderate Muslim in Syria who will fight on our behalf. Now, if I'm an average Syrian citizen, I'm a farmer in Syria, or I'm a guy who works in a factory in Syria, I'm just I'm an average moderate Muslim, right? Family, kids, you know, live in the neighborhood, that kind of thing. And I don't like ISIS. I think they're crazy people. I don't like Assad. I think he's a whack job dictator. Am I going to put a bullseye on my back and on my family's back by saying, yeah, I'll hook up with the Christian infidels, the non-Arab people from the United States who have been bombing the hell out of our region for the last 16 years and who have been occupying our area, you know, our country for the last 100 years and messing with our internal politics and inflicting dictators on us and overthrowing elected governments? Am I going to align myself with the United States? I don't think so. It seems to me like the only people who would be willing to come forward and say, yes, I'm a moderate Muslim, give me some of that $500 million, are the people who are not the moderate Muslims, are the people who know that they're aligned with the right-wing crazies or the hard, whatever you want to call the, you know, ISIS or the Assad government. They're aligned with one or the other, and they're going to use that money for those particular interests, because there is no, you know, there's no leadership to the, quote, moderate Muslims. The so-called Free Syrian Army, half of it is now called ISIS. I mean, it's just the policy itself makes no sense.
This is the military corporate complex.
I know. This is just another welfare program for the guys living in the 34-bedroom mansions, you know, 15 miles north of me in the Virginia suburbs, the defense contractors in their gated communities. And it's wrong, in my opinion. It's just wrong. Let the instead of having the billionaires in Washington, D.C. get an extra $1 billion from this deal, which is what Congress has voted for, we should have the billionaires in Saudi Arabia spend a little bit of their money on defending their own area. So, anyhow, Corky, thanks for the call. Steve in Oak Park, California. Hey, Steve, you want to talk about life and non-life?
Well, you had a guest on, I believe it was on Wednesday, who was debating with you evolution in schools.
Yeah.
And he kept saying, he asked about the Big Bang, and then he kept saying, well, so you believe that life can come from non-life? You believe that life can come from non-life? And my question to him would be, if you don't believe that life can come from non-life, then where did your God come from? Because your God creates things, can have a son, has feelings about things, prefers this over that. It's clearly alive. So where did it come from if life can't come from non-life?
Right. And that, you know, typically the answer to that is either A, that's the great mystery, which is, you know, you want to learn more about it, join our religion and study it for 40 years, or B, there are some questions that just can't be answered. But,
right. And it's funny how they're satisfied with the answer for a deity, but for the Big Bang, you have to have a concrete answer this minute.
Yeah, I know. Go ahead.
Can I just make one other point real quick? You had a guest on, I think it was this week, talking about, you know, in God we trust, in the courts, and, you know, the people who want to put the Ten Commandments up in government buildings. I would just love to see somebody who had the time and the money to also then, everywhere that these people are fighting, I want to see somebody fighting to put Zeus up in every courtroom and Zeus up on every building. Because
yeah.
I feel like he's just as legitimate And you know what? That's the god of the people who invented democracy. So who's more appropriate than Zeus?
Yeah.
And I would just love to see if you have to have your god, then I want my god Zeus.
Well, we need to, you know, you need some Greeks to bring that back, you know, or who is the Roman god of gods?
Was it Jupiter?
Jupiter, I think so. I think so. And of course,
yeah.
I'm personally fond of Odin and Loki and, you know, the Norse gods, you know.
All of them.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
You know what? They all have books written about them.
Yep.
We all have images.
Yep.
They had as many followers for as long of a period of time. They're just as legit.
Yeah. And now you've got, you know, what's interesting is that the Temple of Satan now, because down in Florida, the Supreme Court ruled that it's not a violation of the First Amendment if religious groups bring Bibles into schools and give them out to kids and preach the gospel on a public school. So, and Florida has allowed this to happen several times, citing that Supreme Court amendment. So now the Satanic Temple has come up with a children's book about how to draw pentagrams, you know, the upside down star like the Republicans have on their logo,
right.
Which is the sign of
exactly.
Satan. And they're saying, you know, we want to be in the schools too. We want to pass out our stuff in the schools too. I'm waiting for ISIS to come along and say, hey, we've got some, you know, the Wahhabist version of the Quran, you know, with commentary. That we want to put into the Florida public schools. I think that would be much more entertaining than fighting them in the Middle East. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent points all. It's 15 minutes before the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you are in the D.C. area or you're going to be in the D.C. area this Sunday, day after tomorrow, then be sure to drop by at 5 p.m. Bus Boys and Poets at 5th Street and K. And welcome back, Eric in High Springs, Florida. Hey, Eric, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Okay, thank you. A well-known Republican strategist, lobbyist by the name of Grover Norquist once famously said that he wanted to shrink the size of government down to where it's small enough so that he can drown it in a bathtub.
Right.
I've never forgotten that, and it sounded pretty violent then, sounds violent now. And I feel like I'm under assault, and it feels like my government is under assault. We have to protect this government, this country, from enemies, both foreign and domestic. And that really wraps up how a lot of Republicans feel and how a lot of Tea Partiers are coming into this government in order just to shut it down, in order to abolish existing laws like Rand Paul wants to abolish the minimum wage law so that your employer can pay you $5 an hour. So my question is, ever since Citizens United, where the Supreme Court told us that our politicians can accept undisclosed money, how do we know that terrorists or those who sympathize with terrorists are not funding our political system and our elected officials?
Odds are they already are, or at least groups that sympathize with them. And if certain countries in the Middle East, for example, it's entirely not just possible, but probable. Either the New York Times or the Washington Post, I think it was the Post, did a big expose last weekend about all the foreign money that's being taken by these, quote, think tanks here in Washington, D.C. Some of these think tanks have, you know, are very respectable names and reputations, and yet they're taking money from foreign governments and then issuing, you know, position papers and doing research that seems to favor the positions of those governments. And then lobbyists pick that information up on behalf of these governments and then take it in and lobby members of Congress. And the members of Congress have no idea that the research was funded by the government that's going to be on the receiving end of this. So, A, yes, that's a very real possibility. And, in fact, it is happening at a certain level. We know some of it is happening. But, B, I think that the really important point here is that when Ronald Reagan came into office on the idea that he wanted to run the federal government because the federal government was a terrible thing, and he, in his first inaugural address, he said, government is not the solution to your problems. Government is the problem. That was spitting in the face of George Washington, who had three horses shot out from underneath him trying to create this republic. It was spitting in the face of Thomas Jefferson and all those guys who signed the Declaration of Independence and immediately had death warrants put on every single one of their heads throughout the entirety of the Revolutionary War. It was spitting in the face of Abraham Lincoln, who ultimately paid the ultimate price for trying to hold the Union together. It's just there's a certain level of violence against our country that comes along with this idea that government is bad when government is us. It is our nation. It is the essence of what we are. And I'm with you, Eric, and I think that it's time to, thanks a lot for the call, I think it's time to call these guys out and say you are being fundamentally unpatriotic when you say that government is the problem. And you say that we should just turn the roads over to the billionaires, turn the highways over to the billionaires, turn the waterways over to the billionaires, turn the power systems over to the billionaires, turn our schools over to the billionaires, turn our banks over to the billionaires. You're wrong. It's un-American. Ten minutes before the hour, here on the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Are you at the White House today?
I am. I'm in the basement.
There you go. Okay, so what's going on?
Well, Scottish nationalist Alex Salmond resigned as leader of his party on Friday, that's today, and will quit as first minister of his country after he lost the independence referendum 55-45.
Wow. Was that expected?
Totally unexpected.
Huh. Is he quitting in a fit of pique, or is he quitting because the vote was sufficiently against him that he feels he has no power or no base?
Well, nobody's exactly sure. I mean, you can look at his quitting statement and try and look through it. I mean, he says, I believe that in this new exciting situation, redolent with possibility, party, parliament and country would benefit from new leadership. So he says that. And he doesn't rule out being in politics in the future.
Well, maybe he's quitting because Rick Perry hired him to lead the Texas secession movement.
Well, there you go. But you know, it's maybe he's leaving because that's what you do. It's the right thing to do.
Yeah, maybe
it could be. Now, I mean, everybody expects that, It will be a woman who will lead next, actually, very much, that it will be Nicola Sturgeon, who's his deputy first minister, who will very likely take over from him, and that they may even have made a deal on this. I don't know. An interesting sidebar, but it was really a shock. Nobody expected this because he didn't say it in his concession speech, and then suddenly a few hours later he did.
Right.
An interesting sidebar story to this. I was following the Guardian's live blog, and I noticed that they didn't seem to have anybody at this press conference. And it turns out he tried to bar several newspapers and tried to handpick reporters for his post-referendum press conference.
Oh, no.
Yes, he decided to exclude Scottish political staff.
He's definitely going to work for Rick Perry. I mean, this is Jeff Gannon all over again.
Yeah, he tried to ban the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Mail, and the Express, and then they tried to handpick the journalist who represents the Guardian, so the Guardian refused to go.
Yeah, this guy's got a great future in Republican politics if he just moves to the United States. What else is going on in the world, Victoria?
President Obama said today that recent headlines have forced Americans to talk about sexual assault and domestic violence, and he called on young men to help protect women on college campuses, and he announced a new public awareness campaign today called It's on Us.
Good on him. How about going the next step and stripping the NFL of their antitrust protection and their nonprofit status?
Well, I don't think he can do that. That has to be done by Congress. Maria Cantwell, I think it is Maria Cantwell, who is, well, she's got a bill on the go. Somebody else has another bill on the go.
Interesting.
So, there are a couple of bills wending their way. Cantwell's bill has to do with the getting rid of the Redskins name. Right. Somebody else has a bill getting rid of their tax-exempt status.
Cool. Step by step.
So, it's very interesting. And, in fact, he will be having a press conference this afternoon, Roger Goodell, the commissioner, at 3 p.m. Eastern. responding to the increased criticism, announcing that he's partnering with the domestic violence hotline, the NFL is, and the Sexual Violence Resource Center.
Well, that's, well, is this greenwashing or whitewashing or whatever, or is this a genuine response?
Whether it is whitewashing, the league is going to provide financial, operational, and promotional support to the National Domestic Violence Hotline and the National Sexual Violence Resource Center.
Yeah. I have a question that I'm wondering if anybody has asked any members of Congress or the administration. Senator Sanders was on our program last hour, and he made the point, and which I was unaware of, that the fourth largest military in the world is Saudi Arabia. They're larger than France. They're larger than the UK.
Yeah.
Literally the fourth largest military in the world. And
the
royal family are they're worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Why are we sending our planes, our troops, our soldiers, our blood, our money over to the Middle East to fight ISIL, which is clearly a much greater, clear and present threat to Saudi Arabia, for example, than it is to us?
A lot of people have started asking that very question about many of the Arab Muslim countries, but particularly about Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia has said that it will host the Sunni fighters, the rebels, for training. But, you know, that's like, you know, offering your back garden and a cup of tea to the Saudi Arabians. You could make the argument. But I think increasingly there will be calls that I've just come from the White House briefing today, and Josh Earnest was asked a number of quite pointed questions about how, well, you say it's a coalition of 40 countries. When are they going to step up and actually offer anything? Yes, okay, the French have started airstrikes, but nobody else is doing anything. Now, the president goes to the UN General Assembly in New York next week, and that's where it's expected that on the sidelines or of meetings or in bilateral meetings, he will get much clearer commitments from these countries and hopes to get more countries to sign
up. You know, if we just said, screw it, we're the hell out of here, wouldn't the Saudis then be in a position and the Turks and the Qataris and whatnot where they pretty much had to do something?
Well, I don't think it's clear that they would do anything.
Well, then they deal with the consequences of it.
That's the thing. They might deal with the consequences of it.
Yeah.
And this is what is really, I think, quite extraordinary.
Right. I mean, this is like, you know, our saying to Saudi Arabia, we've got a problem on our border with narco trafficking. Would you please come over and send some drones and some soldiers to deal with the Mexican drug lords? I mean, you know, they look at us like we're crazy.
There are major concerns in the Muslim world about Muslim fighters going and firing on fellow Muslims.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that, and I'm sputtering. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John Nichols is on the line with us, the Washington correspondent for The Nation, thenation.com, although he is right now live in Edinburgh, Scotland. Hey, John.
Hey, did you hear you, Tom?
Say what?
Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. And in fact, your audio sounds great. So the Scots did not vote to separate from the UK, but they got a lot of goodies out of this thing. What are you hearing on the ground there?
Well, it's a dramatic day by any measure. You just referendum with, if you can imagine it, Tom, an 86% turnout. In some parts of Scotland, whole regions had over 90%.
Yeah. We've had we've never had anything like that in the United States, have we?
It's unprecedented. Remember, this is a referendum where you saw 75% turnout in some of the poorest areas of Scotland. So you really are getting a much clearer reflection of the whole people than you ever do in a U.S. election.
Right.
But beyond that, you did have a defeat for the referendum. It lost 55-45. And the First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, who led the fight for the referendum, has stood down today, announcing that he will leave as First Minister, but his party will remain in power. So that's dramatic right there. But the most dramatic development by any measure, and in the great lesson for Americans, is the Scots made a bold demand. They put the issue of independence on the ballot. When the election got close, the English response was to make immense offers to try and keep Scotland within the UK. Remarkably, this morning, British Prime Minister David Cameron announced that he will go forward with a radical devolution of power, not just to Scotland, but to other parts of the United Kingdom.
To Wales and Northern Ireland?
And to the north of England, which is one of the most impoverished parts of the country. Going, you know, not just to the nations that make up the UK, but also to regions of England.
Huh.
And it gets wilder than that. This afternoon, the Queen announced that the royal family will do everything in its power to facilitate this and to assist in the process. So we're seeing, it's almost incomparable to imagine so many amazing changes taking place.
It's almost like the election of FDR.
Yeah. Well, we will see. I mean, there's still going to be a brutal battle. Members of Cameron's own party are pushing back on this. There will be a fight, but the Labour Party is going to have to support this. The Liberal Democratic Party already essentially does. And so we will see over the next 2 to 3 months a remarkable process of remaking the United Kingdom because people made a radical demand. And again, I focus on that. We can, you know, talk about the subtleties of independence. We can talk about, you know, the way the vote came down, all of those things. But there's a powerful lesson here for America. If you ask for a little, you'll get less. If you ask for a lot, you may not get everything you ask for, but you could get something quite remarkable, and that looks to be what's happening here.
Right. We need to start standing up and saying, roll back the Reagan tax cuts, bring back the WPA and the CCC, make the government the employer of last resort, blow up all these international trade deals. I mean, just simple, you know, let's just take us back to an America that worked, right?
Well, and Tom, let's
raise the minimum wage to a living wage. Pardon me.
Let's amend the Constitution to say corporations are not people and
right.
Money is not speech.
There you go.
You know, that's what Scotland did. And Scotland did not vote for independence, but they got a 45% level of support. And if you know anything about politics, what you'll understand is, and I know you do and your listeners do, last week, about a week ago, there was evidence that the Scots might well vote for independence.
Right.
It was at that point that the British made huge promises. So making a big demand and seeing it through, the lesson is big things can happen.
Yeah, absolutely. John, I'm going to let you go now because your Skype is starting to disintegrate, but your points are so well made, and I so appreciate your reporting for us live on the ground there in Scotland today. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom, and keep strong, and we'll talk about some of these things more, I hope.
Indeed, when you get back. I'm looking forward to it. John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation, thenation.com, check it out. And I'm sure John will be writing about this at some depth on the nation's website. Anything Goes Friday. Ken in Loveland, Colorado. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a veteran, and I was fortunate enough to be in Washington, D.C. last weekend as part of an honor flight. And while we were touring the monuments, I heard this loud roar, and I just figured it was a presidential helicopter. But it turned out to be an Osprey aircraft. I mean, I'm sure you know what those are. They're huge.
Yeah.
I thought they were mothballed years ago.
Yeah.
But apparently we bought 12 of them for $70 million apiece. That's like $8.5 billion. They cost $11,000 an hour to operate, and the president can't even fly them. I mean, his staff and a press corps and his dog flew to Martha's Vineyard, and he flew in a standard helicopter. So
right.
I was wondering who actually gets to decide how we buy these things and waste this kind of money. Thank you.
You're welcome. Ken, I'm sorry I don't know the answer to your question. I can give you an educated guess. I live in the Washington Channel. Louise and I live in a boat in the marina, the public marina down here, and the channel is the path that the helicopters fly up and down all day long, and we get helicopters going to and from the Pentagon, we get helicopters going to and from the White House, and we get the Coast Guard helicopters going over, you know, up and down. So I'm real familiar with the helicopters, and I have seen an Osprey once or twice, or at least what I thought was an Osprey. It was a plane that had the engines that can flip up and go, you know, vertical takeoff. I would guess that Congress appropriates specific amounts for specific weapon systems, and I'm quite sure of that. I think that's the reason why you find these weapons manufacturers putting small factory locations in literally every state, every congressional district in the country. The F-35, some piece of it was built in every single congressional district in the country. It's why it's like, you know, trying to get rid of a vampire. You drive a stake through its heart, but you know, there's no heart. I mean, how do you find it? So, it's conceivable that these were decisions that were made at the level of the Pentagon, you know, with discretionary funds, but I'm guessing that Congress had something to do with it. Mary in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mary, you wanted to talk about the Heritage Foundation's argument about the war on poverty?
Yes. Hi, Tom. You keep my sanity every day.
Well, thank you.
Left of it. I'm calling about the gentleman from the Heritage Foundation, or should I say the Koch-funded Heritage Foundation, who was proposing that we needed work programs for people on welfare.
Right.
And the reason I'm calling is that I am on welfare, and when I applied, I was told that I had to work. Now, I did not have to work because I'm over 65 and I am disabled.
Mm-hmm.
But I have in front of me, from the Pennsylvania Department of Public Welfare publication, the Employment Placement Services that says cash and SNAP, which is food stamps, recipients are either required to participate in an employment or in training activity, or if exempt, can volunteer to participate. Employment and training activities may include subsidized or unsubsidized employment, work experience, on-the-job training, job search, job readiness, community service, and vocational education.
And
workfare has been in place since Clinton's administration.
Yeah, this was Newt Gingrich's big accomplishment. I disagree with him, too. There's a large percentage of the poor population of the United States are elderly, are disabled, or are, you know, single parents with young kids. And I think telling these people that they have to work is nuts. Mary, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Don't forget, this Sunday here in Washington, D.C., 5 p.m. at Bus Boys and Poets on 5th and K, Dan Sisson and me will be talking about Dan's new book. And welcome back. Is it Zeta or Zada in Frewsburg, New York, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network?
It's Zeta.
Zeta, welcome.
I have good grasp. Yes, I'm a first-time caller, but I've been a long-time listener, and I have exciting grassroots news.
Okay.
About an 85-year-old woman in Sarasota, Florida, who's going to begin a Granny D walk from Sarasota to Tallahassee for campaign finance reform.
Uh-huh.
And she's being sponsored by Move to Amend.
Uh-huh.
And she's going to try to convince the Florida legislature to join the other states who want to amend the Citizens United Amendment.
Oh, that's great.
And I don't have a question. Her name is Rana Zini. She's 85, and she's going to start her walk October 13th.
That's great. And people can find out about that by going to moveon.org?
Move to Amend. And
Move to Amend.
Also, and also her name, Rana, period, Granny D's Footsteps .com.
Okay, great. So people can track that down. Zeta, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. It's much appreciated. Thank you.
Oh, I love you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now. Jared in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Jared, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on cable there in Burlington. You wanted to talk about carbon?
Yeah, but first I'd like to make a comment, if I may. Dan Sisson was on your show a few days ago,
mm-hmm.
And I thought it sounded like a book I wanted to read, so I called Barnes & Noble. They don't have it.
They've never heard of it. It's just coming out right now. They can order it, and they may have it in their store the next week or so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. With regard to carbon, there's a lot of talk whether to have carbon tax or carbon cap.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is waste. Whether the waste is produced by nukes or whether the waste is produced by mining or however, whether it's produced by fracking, I think that's the one that I'd like to hear you talk about. I think that's the one that I think we need to address is the production of waste by mankind.
Yeah. Yeah. We are the only species on Earth to make it singular, we are the only one on Earth whose waste is not food for somebody else. Every other life form, you know, consumes the waste of some other life form, or even the death of other life forms. And I suppose that, you know, in death we're the food for other things. Although if we embalm people well enough and put them in concrete graves, it doesn't do that. But we need to be thinking in those terms that nuclear waste, for example, lives for millions of years and is toxic to people. Our carbon, the carbon that we're pulling out from beneath the crust of the earth and throwing up into the atmosphere is going to be with us for arguably hundreds of thousands of years. And I'm absolutely with you. And in fact, the proposals for a carbon tax take into account the waste that is produced, for example, in fracking, the waste that is produced in mining. They are part of the way that you value the cost of carbon. Your point is really well made, Jared. Thank you for calling and making it. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, speaking the truth to multinational corporations. We'd really rather you didn't know all about David in Mill City, Oregon. Hey, David, what's up?
Two things regarding this problem in Syria, Saudi, and Iraq,
right,
be it ISIL or whatever you want to call them. The first is sort of a question: is the accuracy of the translations from the Arabic that the leader of that group is saying? Significantly, the question is he asking that they reestablish the Islamic caliphate, or is he talking about establishing a Islamic caliphate? There being a major significant difference between the two.
What is that difference?
The caliphate, when it was at its peak, extended all the way across North Africa, Spain, Greece, the Balkans, Sicily, southern Italy.
Right, you're talking about the old Ottoman Empire.
Well, this predates the Ottoman Empire.
Okay.
This is, in other words, this is when Charlemagne hit the Battle of Tours, when they stopped them from coming over the Pyrenees in France.
Right.
Okay.
Now,
and the question.
But isn't the word caliphate, I mean, it's sort of like the Catholic Church. Catholic means the one true one, right? Isn't caliphate, by definition, there can only be one?
Yes. And okay. But the question comes is if his mind is establishing a Islamic state in the area, that's one thing. If his idea is, let's go back to where we were, it's another thing.
Right. Right.
And then the other point is, you've been asking about why the Saudi army. I'm not sure we want the Saudi army. The problem is that the Saudi army is made up of Wahhabi Muslims. The only difference between them and the fundamentalists in ISIL is that both of them believe in the concept of one religion, one state, one leader. The only difference between the two is that the Wahhabis are accepting the House of Saud as the leader.
Right, right. This is a deal, which is a deal that goes back to the 1740s. Yeah.
Right. Well, And so the question then comes is, the army marches out, the fourth best, one of the fourth largest armies in the world, and one of the best equipped, and changes sides.
Yeah.
Now what?
Again, not my problem.
I didn't say it's our... Well, yes. Well, it is our problem if their goal is a restoration of the Ottoman Empire.
Even that's not my problem. I live in North America. If they want to take Southern Europe, that's, let the Spaniards deal with it.
But you got to remember that sitting in the middle of this is Israel. And there's a problem.
Israel's got a very, very potent military force. They've got nuclear weapons. They can take care of themselves.
Oh, I didn't say they couldn't take care of themselves. I'm just saying is that the world oil supply gets really interesting when large quantities of it turns radioactive, because the Israelis are not going to go quietly into the dark.
Right. I think that may be the best thing that could happen to not nuclear war, obviously, but the Arab oil embargo of the 70s, of the early 70s, in addition to leading to the inflation here in the United States throughout the 70s, also led Jimmy Carter to come up with a plan to make us completely non-dependent on Middle Eastern oil by the year 1990 and have 20% of our electricity coming from solar power by the year 2000. And we would have beat those goals if Ronald Reagan hadn't undone all that legislation when he came into office
with
big oil money. So if all of a sudden, the Middle Eastern oil went off the market, the price of oil went to $160 a barrel, suddenly solar and wind aren't just competitive. They're the only option in town.
Yep. No. In that respect, there is a positive benefit. I'm just looking at this thing and going that we need to make sure that we understand what's going to happen or what the potential is.
Right. Outside of humanitarian concern for average citizens on the ground, which should be a concern of the Saudis as well. These people are more closely related to them in terms of language, culture, religion, ethnicity, all those things. And not just the Saudis, but the other countries in the region. Outside of the humanitarian concerns, David, all of these geopolitical concerns, including oil, I think are all reasons why we should not be in that region, why we should let that region sort out its own stuff, and we need to get about the business of doing Germany's on course to be 60% solar in the next decade. They're almost 50% solar right now. We could easily do that. We could do that in 5 years if we put half the effort into it that we put into World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just saying, I'm not completely convinced that we... even with those two factors factored in, whether we need to participate. I'm just saying that the debate needs to include those two factors.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. But I think the thing that Bernie points out, that Saudi Arabia has the fourth largest military in the world, and why the hell are they standing on the sideline? Why are there billionaire families saying, you guys fight for us, please?
Not only that, is their billionaire families are some of them are sending financial aid to the...
To ISIL. ISIS. And in part, John McCain and Lindsey Graham went over there, met with Prince Bandar Bush, Badr bin Sultan, and you know, who is the defense minister in Saudi Arabia, said, "Would you please give a bunch of money to the Sunni guys, you know, guys like you who are in Syria, who are willing to bring down Assad?" Badr Bush says, "Okay, cool. Here's a bunch of money." He goes, raises it from a bunch of private Saudis, passes that money over to them. That group of you know, Saudi funded anti Assad Sunnis becomes ISIS. John McCain and Lindsey Graham helped it all happen. The Saudis are looking at this going, this is not going the way it's supposed to go. And they fire Badr Bush. They've got a new guy in now. And they're rethinking their foreign policy. Like, maybe we should just not be involved in any of this. Or at the most, we'll do like we did during the first Gulf War with George Herbert Walker Bush. We'll give him an Air Force base. That worked out really well. That was why bin Laden did 9/11. It's because we had an Air Force base in Saudi Arabia. David, I'm with you. This, we need to have a thoughtful, principled, meaningful conversation. No more bumper stickers on this stuff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And to that point, Jim McDermott in the House of Representatives and Bernie Sanders in the United States Senate have issued some of the most cogent statements. I encourage you to read. It's the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? It's the True People's Media. It's talk media for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And Taylor in San Jose, California. Hey, Taylor, you had a question about libertarians?
Yes, my question. I have a question and a quick comment after that. I'm dealing a lot with younger libertarians who claim that they are not right. They claim to they have moved away from the right wing. And I'm getting a lot of accusations of liberals, you are progressives, you are just as biased as any right winger. In fact, you're just as bad as, you know, people who listen to Rush Limbaugh. I mean, I've been accused of, you know, oh, you listen to your left-wing talk radio. You're just as brainwashed. And my question is, without getting rid of Citizens United, is there any way to combat that stigma that progressivism has the same brainwashing going on as the right wing?
Well, this is the message that the Koch brothers want young people to believe. It's why they're funding campus organizations all across the country. They, you know, if young people can be convinced to be so cynical as to believe that both conservatives and progressives, but particularly progressives, are somehow evil or unpatriotic or un-American, then that just opens more space for the billionaires to control more of the commons of the United States. And that's their agenda. Very simply, the billionaires want to control the commons. They want to be able to decide how much pollution they dump into our air. They want to be able to control the things that we all need and use, like power, internet, television, water, septic. I mean, you name it, they want to run it. And until you can have a conversation with your libertarian friends where they have to articulate what their actual philosophy is. That's not bumper stickers. I mean, you can say smaller government all day long, but say, well, what does that mean? You know, what would you do about the EPA, for example? Oh, you don't mind if the Koch brothers build a paper mill next to you and blow pollution all over your town, or an oil refinery next to you? That just let the free market figure it out. There's no such thing as a free market. I mean, at some point we've got to have these actual policy discussions, and libertarians, you know, young idealistic or even old idealistic libertarians are suckers for the billionaires, and you need to just tell them that to their face.
I have been told them that to their face. And my quick comments are, I'll make it quick. Yesterday, your guest talking about Progressive Democrats of America, I am going to get involved, going to stop being a spectator, because that just speaks so truly to my support for Bernie Sanders and believing that I don't like the Clintonian Democrats. So that's something I want to get involved in.
Cool.
And speaking on the anti-American side of the right wing, first of all, the Huffington Post said there was a poll out there where a quarter of the people said they supported secession. Mm-hmm. And my other comment on that is I'm in the military. I'm getting out. And it is startling the amount of anti-American, pro-militia, the world's going to end, just get ready to, you know, stockpile your weapons. The amount of people in the military I know that believe in that.
Right.
And
going so far as to make just, you know, lucid verbal attacks on the president's life and his religion and everything while in uniform. And I just wanted, I don't know if other military members could weigh in on that. It's been very startling for me to see the amount of anti-American philosophy that I've seen in military members that are, you know, serving, supposedly serving the U.S.,
right,
but they essentially hate the country.
Yeah.
And where it's going.
Or at least they hate this, the black guy in the White House. But I think it goes beyond that. We've got a billionaire class in this country that is funding a whole variety of hate America programs. Hate American government, hate American presidents, hate American programs, hate you know, your neighbor if they're poor, hate your neighbor if their skin color is wrong, hate their neighbor if they're the wrong religion. And these are being funded by the billionaires so that we will not be talking about how they're ripping us all off. And that's the bottom line. And, I'm familiar with what you're talking about in the military. And some of it comes out of the Christian fundamentalism groups who are now aligned with the hard right and some of these, you know, wacky pastors and all this kind of stuff. And others are just coming out of the whole Alex Jones conspiracy theory crowd. And it's very, very unfortunate. I'm sorry I don't have an easy answer for it, Taylor. Thanks a lot for the call, though, and thanks. Go ahead.
Okay. Do you think we could I always thought that if all the Democrats just kind of got together and were actual progressives, with every second they spent on the media, they talked like Bernie Sanders.
Right.
I feel like that would turn the tables.
It would. Here's the thing, though. Bernie Sanders has been on Face the Nation once. It's like they do not invite on progressive voices. They don't. And if they're going to bring a Democrat on, it's going to be a kind of middle of the road Chuck Schumer corporate friendly Democrat. And because they control the megaphone, they control the media, and they are giant transnational corporations themselves. So they're not going to put somebody on who's makes a living trashing giant transnational corporations. And that's a problem with our media, that, you know, our media really needs to be broken up and relocalized. But Taylor, thank you for the call, and thank you for your service to our country. Terry in Chicago. Hey, Terry, in 1893, on this date?
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Yes, a big day in progressive world history. New Zealand became the first nation to give women the right to vote.
Wow.
Which is huge for us. And I've heard so little about it today, and it's like, we can't just let this day go by and not give some recognition that we were finally recognized as citizens, true citizens, that we got our voice.
That's great. I'm sorry I was unaware of that, Terry, but thank you for sharing that with all of us. And
I love your show. I'm inspired to be a better, more informed citizen every time I listen to your show, Tom, and I applaud you for all that you've done for us. And another quick thing, being from the Chicago area, you know, Harley-Davidson got its birth here.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading today that Harley-Davidson is putting a factory over in India to build motorcycles over there for sale overseas.
Right.
Have you heard anything on that?
No, but it doesn't surprise me. That's, you know.
Exactly. And I'm thinking that's the first step, the slippery slope into, well, you know, it's cheaper to build them over there.
It may well be.
That's sad because it's an American institution.
Well, this is why we need to get rid of these stupid trade deals and, you know, that just dropped all of our tariffs, all of our protections for American workers and, you know, made us basically bare naked in front of the entire world. And we're the only country, major developed country, that doesn't have protectionist trade policies. Everybody else pretends they don't, but they do. We say we don't, and we don't. And spot on, Terry. But thank you for the tip on 1893. This day in history, New Zealand gave women the right to vote. Good on them, and ultimately good on us, 1920. But thank you, Terry. Thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Dave in Smyrna, Tennessee. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Tom, I wanted to address the guest that you had earlier from the Heritage Association.
Foundation, yeah.
About jobs in this country. One of the things that I think has changed drastically over the years was the fact that there used to be a time when businesses would invest in employees in terms of training. Now they're so interested in getting people who are, quote unquote, ready to hit the ground running that you know, it's harder for people to get some of those high-tech jobs that are out there nowadays. And if you have to, as a potential employee, invest in training yourself, there's always the potential that the job that you're looking for 4 years down the road in terms of training just might not be there when you get fully trained.
You're right.
And there was a time when unions would actually step in and say, look, we'll take the responsibility and we'll make sure that this person is trained to do this job.
Sure. That was a major role of unions in things like I know the machinist union because my dad worked in a tool and die shop. And, you know, they had a whole apprenticeship program where you could eventually become a journeyman and qualify for the, you know, the good pay. We used to do that. The other the big piece that is missing from your analysis, Dave, that I would like to over and over and over again point out needs to be in there is that we used to say in the United States that there is no such thing as work without dignity, that all work has dignity. That whether somebody is flipping burgers, whether somebody is cleaning sewers, whether somebody is you know a janitor, or whether the dean of the college, whatever job they have, there's sufficient dignity associated with work, with working a 40-hour week and keeping your nose clean, that if you do that, you should be able to raise a family, and that was the prevailing notion until Reaganomics. And with Reaganomics, that started to fall apart. And now, 34 years of Reaganomics later, we see about half of the American middle class is now the American working poor. And we need to go back to saying there is no such thing as work that does not have dignity. So that when people have these, quote, entry-level jobs, you know, working at McDonald's, even though the average age of a McDonald's worker is 29, when they have these low-paying jobs, they can actually raise a family on them. And they can actually afford to go to school. This is the other piece of it, is we need to be offering free college education and free trade school education. They can actually afford to go to school. And if we were to change our trade policy, bringing our manufacturing jobs back and then bring our unions back, we could really have a middle class. So, Dave, you touched on a lot of really important stuff. Thanks a lot for the call. Very, very, very important stuff. We will be right back. It's 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And don't forget, this Sunday at 5 p.m., our new book, The Revolution of 1800, Busboys and Poets, 5 p.m. right here in D.C. Dan Sisson and me. Welcome back. And let's see, Free Speech TV, James in Spokane, Washington, watching us on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, James, what's up?
What's going on with you, Tom? Good morning, good afternoon.
Thank you.
I want to change the topic to the first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
I heard some rumors, and I wonder if there's any evidence that you've heard of, that Kuwaiti interests and USA interests were slant drilling into Iraqi oil fields.
Oh, that's a matter of public record. Kuwait was stealing Iraq's oil, and Saddam Hussein first yelled about it in the press, tried to yell about it at the United Nations. Nobody was listening. And then he met with April Gillespie, who was our State Department representative to him, to that area, and said, I'm going to, you know, and Kuwait used to be a province of Iraq. So he referred to it as the 37th or 38th province. He said, we're going to take back the 38th province. Will the George Herbert Walker Bush administration try to stop me? And April Gillespie basically said, no, go for it. And he did. And then, you know, immediately you've got the daughter of the former Kuwaiti ambassador pretending that she was not, you know, testifying before Congress, lying to Congress about having seen with her own eyes, which was a lie, Iraqi soldiers tearing babies out of incubators in Kuwaiti hospitals. Never happened. And it's just, you know, it's mind-boggling. I mean, you know, the first Gulf War was fought based on lies, and it set up 9/11, and it set up the second Gulf War, and, you know, from Poppy Bush to Baby Bush.
And false flag operations all over the times to instigate these incidents.
It could be false flag operations, or it could just be, you know, stupid foreign policy. I mean, what did you have in mind?
Skewed media. I don't know.
I realize there are some people who think that 9/11 might have been a false flag operation. You know, I think Occam's razor. I think the simple explanation is that when bin Laden in 1998 said, I am going to attack you if you don't do two things. Number one, get your damn forces out of Saudi Arabia. You've been there since the first Gulf War in the 1990s, or late 80s, whenever it was. You've been there ever since then, and you've got men drinking alcohol and women driving cars and showing their elbows. It's blasphemy. You must get out, which, by the way, George W. Bush did in 2004. He pulled our forces out of Saudi Arabia, so he gave bin Laden what he wanted after he let him go at Tora Bora. So that was number one. And number two was, you're only paying $30 a barrel for oil from Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabia is the homeland of our religion. It is sacred ground. This is sacred oil. You should be paying at least $100 a barrel for it. Guess what? We're paying $100 a barrel for Saudi oil now. So it's like, you know, bin Laden got what he wanted. And the other thing he said he was going to do was he was going to bleed us dry. And, you know, here we are $3 trillion later and probably another $3 trillion to go as a result of Bush and Cheney's illegal, stupid, ill-considered, mind-bogglingly destructive wars. So, you know, James, thanks for the call. We need to learn from this lesson, right? We got lied to by an administration. This was a criminal administration, the Bush administration. When you have elected people in office who are lying to the people, and those lies lead to deaths, that's a crime. Frankly, it's a crime at law. It's also a political crime. It's a form of at the very least sedition. And something that we should recognize. The longer we go as a nation without acknowledging the crimes of the Bush administration, or for that matter, the crimes of the Reagan administration, the longer we go without acknowledging and punishing those crimes, the worse it gets. Our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our board op, Troy Miller, to writer-researchers Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly. You can see their work at our newly reinvented TomHartman.com website. To our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at all the companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, On Dish Network, Direct TV, all the other cable providers who carry our show, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio on netrootsradio.com, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and hey, to the folks in the chat room, I realize it's down today for maintenance, but hey, anyway, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. You make it possible. You really do. And, you know, when you call a station and let them know that you're listening and appreciate the show, or when you call an advertiser or a sponsor or an underwriter and say thank you, it means a lot. It goes a long, long way. Michael in Los Angeles. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, you wanted to talk about President Eisenhower?
Yeah. I pretty much consider him the last, like, truly great president. And I was wondering what you think he would do with some of the things today with either, like, the inequality gap from the Reagan tax cuts or ISIS or Putin or any of that.
Well, you know, Eisenhower defended a 91% top income tax rate on the rich. He defended the integration of the armed forces that was started by FDR and put on steroids by Harry Truman. In his famous letter to his brother Edgar, he talked about, you know, these right wing Texas oil men. He said their numbers are small and they are stupid. Eisenhower, there's a lot, you can argue that there's a lot of bad stuff that happened on the Eisenhower administration. A lot of it had to do with foreign policy, which was his vice president's portfolio. That was Richard Nixon. You know, what we did in Iran, overthrowing Mossadegh, what we did in Iraq. I'm forgetting the guy's name who was elected there and helping bring to power Saddam Hussein. A lot of that happened during the Eisenhower administration. Some of the Banana Republic stuff, ITT down in Chile and Honduras. It wasn't all goodness and light, but Eisenhower was a big defender of unions. When he ran for reelection in 1956, and you can easily find this online, read the Republican Party's platform in the 1956 election. He ran on the fact that more than 1 million people had been added to the Social Security rolls. He'd expanded Social Security. He ran on the fact that more than 2 million more people were members of unions in the United States. He ran on supporting labor. He ran, in 1952, when he ran for president successfully, he ran on an anti-war platform. The whole thing was, you know, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. In fact, here's the clip right here.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
I mean, this is the president who ran for election on vote for peace. And, I'd say the only president who's done that since then successfully was Barack Obama, running on, you know, I'm going to end the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, which he's kind of halfway toward doing, although it's getting spooky. But, Michael, there's a lot that we could learn from Eisenhower. And one of these days I'm going to have to drag out my Eisenhower clips and play them, because it's particularly his farewell address. It is absolutely brilliant. Michael, thank you for the call. I don't know exactly what he would do today or what he would say today, but I do know that I do believe that he was one of our high integrity presidents. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. You know, the war on climate change really is de facto World War III, and we've essentially surrendered. And if we lose this war, it truly will be the war that ends all wars.
How and when did we surrender?
How do we? Because we are 40, 50 years into this and doing very, very little. I'm just saying we're making such a marginal attempt at it.
Yeah.
That I don't have much time. I just wanted, if you could give a shout out, which has been covered by essentially nobody, of the People's Climate March around the world and around this country.
Yeah, this weekend.
On Sunday.
Yes, this weekend in New York City. In fact, I should have mentioned it more frequently during the show. Thank you for bringing it up, Bill.
It's getting no coverage.
Yeah. I have not mentioned it today. That's my bad. My bad. Sunday, if there's going to be people from all over the world. Well, actually, Bernie talked about it some. But there's going to be people from all over the world coming to New York City this weekend, and it's a big deal. This is a BFD, as Joe Biden would say. Thanks a lot for the call. Paul, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, you've got a new slogan for Move to Amend?
Yes, Tom. I want to say thank you to Danielle, your phone answerer, because she's very patient and very, and she's a lovely lady. I'm elderly, I'm disabled, and I'm passing this on to you if maybe they can use it, because I can't do much campaigning because of my health situation. But what it is, it basically is very simple, and I don't know why nobody ever thought of it, but if money is speech, speech is no longer free.
Oh, that's interesting. If money is speech, then speech is no longer free. That's brilliant.
Somebody ought to tell the Supreme Court that, you know.
Yeah. And the American people, you know, what's the old "Who will tell the people"? If money is speech, then speech is no longer free. Excellent point. Paul, thank you for the call, and thanks for making that point. We've only got about 20 seconds left. I've got, Jerry and Ivan and Bobby and Davis and Andy and the others here on the board. My apologies not being able to get to your calls today. But there is this climate march going on this weekend in Washington, in New York City. It is a big deal. The UN is going to be meeting. There's a climate summit. We've got a couple of videos coming out. Get over to greenworldrising.org, and you can see what we're up to with our climate videos that were put together by Leonardo DiCaprio, Earl Katz, George DiCaprio, Lila Connors, myself, Sam Sachs, a few other people. There's a bunch of good stuff out there. So pass it along. Get out there, get active, show up. Oh, and also Sunday, if you happen to be in D.C. instead of New York City, come by Bus Boys and Poets at 5 p.m. Dan Sisson and I will be talking about our new book, The Revolution of 1800. Remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you next week.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.